everybody. We will begin this board meeting of the Board of Directors for Upper San Gabriel Valley Municipal Water District. It is 4 p.m. on January 24th. We will begin with the Pledge of Allegiance. Please rise.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We'll move on to roll call of the Board of Directors. Vanessa?
Director Trevino?
Present.
Director Chavez?
Present.
Director Garcia?
Present.
Vice President Fellow?
Here.
President Santana?
Here. All board members are present. Next, we have adoption of the agenda. Do I have a motion and a second?
So moved.
Second. We have a motion and a second from Trevino and Director Garcia. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? That passes on a 5-0. Next, we have public comments. Do we have any public comments?
Good afternoon, Madam President. We have not received any written public comments. However, if anyone wishes to speak now, they may do so at the podium.
Okay. Seeing none, we'll move on to committee reports. So we have one committee report in our packet, the Government Affairs Community Outreach. We do have one committee that we had a bizarre schedule due to the holiday. So I just wanted to mention and remind everybody, I know it was an odd schedule. However, if the chair or vice chair are not present, then the meeting cannot be conducted for these committees. So please, if you are not able to attend, just a reminder, communicate with staff, communicate with the chair, vice chair, whoever officer is there, so that they are aware and we can cancel the meeting beforehand.
President Santana, may I add? The board president, President Santana, does the committee appointments for the coming year, we will work with those committee members on their schedules and do our best to schedule those committee meetings at convenient times for the committee members.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, that's another thing coming up is the committee committee appointments. And yeah, I was going to mention that later, but yes, as Tom mentioned, absolutely flexible based on the schedule of your availability. And should any committee, if anybody's interested in a committee or change in a committee, please let me know, directors. And as Tom said, the time can be adjusted to fit your schedule. Okay. Moving on to the consent calendar. Do I have a motion and a second for the consent?
So moved.
Director Garcia, second. Director Trevino. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? All right, that passes on a 5-0. Next on the agenda, we do have the representative for our different agencies. There is currently in our packet the 2023 appointments and at-will representatives. It's, I don't know, about halfway through maybe. On the back, here's what we had for 2023, if anybody hasn't seen it yet. I'm going to take each one individually. The first one, item A, appointment of representative and an alternate to the Association of Cal Water Agencies Joint Powers Insurance Authority. Currently, it is myself, and then Director Fellow is the alternative. The meetings are February, April, May, and December at the Aqua Conference and the Aqua Legislative Symposium. Is anybody interested in taking that on? Anybody new? Okay. We will go ahead and remain the representatives. I shall remain the representative, and Director Fellow shall remain the alternate. Does that work?
Staff, do we need to reappoint every year on those?
We have to check, Tom. I'm not quite sure. For the JPIA.
To be on the safe side, can we do it by motion and vote?
Yeah, sure.
To reappoint.
Okay. Can I get a motion in a second to, this would be for Jennifer, for myself as representative and Director Fellow as alternative.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? All right, that passes on a 5-0. Moving on to the appointment of representative and an alternate to the San Gabriel Valley Water Association. For 2023, we had Director Garcia as the rep and Director Fellow as the alternate. It meets the fourth Monday every month at 11:30 a.m. Is there any discussion on this?
I cannot continue to do that just because of the time.
Right. You're very busy with your job and everything like that. But we understand that. Okay.
Madam Chair, I go to all the meetings. I don't mind, even if you want to switch.
Yeah, we can switch. I don't mind being the alternate. Occasionally I can go, but okay. not all the time.
That sounds good to me. Do we have any other comments? Okay. So could we get a motion and a second for Director Fellow as the representative and Director Garcia as the alternate for this?
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Director Garcia and Director Chavez, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay. So for 2024, we will have Director Fellow as the representative, Director Garcia as the alternate. Moving on to item C, this is appointment of a representative to the San Gabriel Valley Protective Association. Currently, I am the representative. This is a one-time meeting in April. I'm happy to continue that, but I'm also happy to entertain if anybody's interested in taking that on.
When is it?
it's the middle of the day, 11:30.
Okay.
Yeah. Typically, 11:30. Right, Linda?
The lunch meeting.
2 o'clock? 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
Okay.
That sounds more right, yeah.
You guys like lunch.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I was looking at the wrong one.
Yeah. So it is once a year, and I'll fill you all in on the on that. So I will go ahead and is there a motion and a second for myself to remain the representative on that? So move Director Carreño, second Director Garcia. Thank you very much. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Okay. Passes on a 5-0. And then finally, we have the San Gabriel Valley Council of Governments. This is an alternating seat where we share with two other water districts. For 2023, you can see that's highlighted, we were the alternate, and for 2024, we will be the representatives for the SGV COG. Currently, we had Director Garcia for 2023 as the representative. The board meetings are the third Thursday of each month, and the Water Committee and Water Working Group are the first Wednesday of each month at 1 p.m., 4 p.m., and 1 p.m., respectively. So, do we have anybody interested in taking...
Madam Chair, yes? I'd like to just make a comment. We've talked about this. I think we should really talk about whether we should belong to the San Gabriel Valley Council of Governments. I don't know if it benefits us. And I've been the representative. As a councilman, I've been on the board. And there's also some other instances that deal with some of the council members that have not been good. But it's something we should think about. And I don't know if we'd have to talk maybe to the other district. I don't see the benefits, to be honest with you.
So, in fact, I checked on this, and our membership renewal is fiscal year, Patty?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And we split the roughly $33,000 membership with the other two water agencies. Mm-hmm. So what we will plan to do as staff, we will bring several of these organizations and association memberships to the through the Government Affairs Committee to the board for consideration whether we continue the membership in those. It'll certainly be COG and the other ones that we are members of that we pay dues to. Staff will have some recommendations. Some of them will be entirely up to the board. Well, they're all up to the board. I shouldn't say that. But we may have some specific recommendations on some, whether we keep or do not continue the membership. The others will just let the board discuss and determine that. So we will plan to do that around the May-June timeframe.
Well, we'll actually begin the conversation during the budget process for next year's fiscal year. So beginning in February, we'll be entering into the budget discussions for Gov Affairs, or for community outreach, I should say.
Yeah, yeah. So these come up in the budget. We approve, you know, we include them in the budget if we're going to continue the membership. So okay. It'll be in the next few months.
I think that sounds good.
Question? So at our previous office on Huntington, we used to host them. Now that we're in this new building, are we still hosting them?
They have their own facility now with a big enough room to host their board meetings.
Okay.
So for a period of time, they were over at the Foothill, was it the Foothill Transit?
Yeah.
And they didn't have sufficient space. And because they were after hours, their meetings would go beyond our staff's work time. We'd be paying staff overtime. So we suggested that they pay a minimal amount to cover our time, and that's when they found another meeting location. Mm-hmm. So
now I thought it would be awkward if we were hosting them, and then we weren't participating.
We weren't members anymore. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Any other comments, questions? Okay. Well, this one's kind of up in the air. I would like to nominate Director Garcia to continue, if that's all right with you, Director Garcia.
Yeah, I just want to clarify. The Water Committee and Water Working Group I cannot make, but the board meeting I can. So is that, okay, just making sure.
Yeah, that's the main representation is on the COG governing board.
Got it.
The Water Committee, I cover the Water Committee usually. And so...
So definitely don't need to.
Yeah. The committees you want to attend are entirely up to you. It's the main representation on the COG governing board. Okay.
Then yes, I would like to do that.
Wonderful. Okay, great. Can I get a motion and a second for Director Garcia?
So moved.
Second.
Second, excellent. We have a motion from Director Fellow, second from Director Chavez. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? That passes on a 5-0. All right, those are the appointments and at-will representatives for 2024. Thank you all very much. We shall now move on to Stephen O'Neill, District Council, providing us a presentation on AB 1234 Ethics Overview.
Well, this is for Vanessa from here. Yeah. So I've got a presentation, it's probably about 30 to 35 minutes.
And Steve, if I may, so the directors and management staff are required to do 2 hours of ethics training once every 2 years. Now, some of us do that. We go to a class at Aqua, and we get a certificate. But I thought it might be more convenient for the board if over the course of the year or the 2 years, we have some short presentations from our legal counsel on Brown Act, conflicts of interest, other topics related to ethics, so that you can get your 2 hours of ethics training here in the board meeting. So that's what we would plan to do. We'll do about a half an hour or so today. And sometime later this year, we'll do another session. And that way, all the board and the executive staff are up to date on their ethics training certificates.
So question, Madam President.
Yes.
So if 3 members show up, do we have to post it as a meeting?
That sounds like
is a microphone working?
So if 3 members show up for
the ethics training, is it considered a constitute a meeting?
It would be a meeting.
And does it need to be posted in the public open?
So the way we're doing it today, it is at a board meeting, so yes.
But if we do the training.
So if 3 directors are at Aqua in the training, it's obviously not a board meeting.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure I mentioned.
Because it gets to what constitutes a meeting for purposes of the Brown Act. It's actually one of the slides I'm going to get to.
Okay.
So with that, I'll get started, Tom, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Sure. So what I have is a pretty brief overview. I'm sure most of you, this is going to be a refresher for most of you because I'm tackling today pretty much the fundamental stuff. Why we're here, the AB 1234. And the areas where these most common issues arise, and in my experience, that's the Brown Act, it's conflict of interest, and then some smaller discussions like gift receiving, et cetera. So can I... Is that me? My phone, maybe? Let me try that. So I just want to start talking about Assembly Bill 1234, because that was really... the legislature's attempt to really kind of put a little more control on the local agencies and how they compensate their directors. It's really designed to formalize the compensation procedures, and it was a recent addition to the government code. I'm trying to think if it was in the mid-2000s, I think, is when they came up with it, but it did impose some kind of more formal requirements. Next slide, please. And it created a series of statutes, new statutes in the government code that... impose these requirements, and it allows for compensation, of course, for director attendance at meetings, committees, etc. And it requires that the agency have a written policy. And if you need to look at our policy, go to our policy manual, look at section 2.6, and you'll see the requirements and the policy we have for compensation for directors. As a sidelight that's not on the slide, I will let you know that there are 2 compensation structures in the codes that govern our district. the original code from the Municipal Water District Act of 1911, it says that a director is entitled to only 6 meetings a month, and every meeting is $100 flat. However, there's a companion statute in the water code called the Uniform the Uniform District Compensation Act that has a provision that allows for a sliding scale. And so the district has been on that, like every other municipal water district I represent is using that that structure that allows you to have a sliding scale that I think it can go up every year not to exceed 5%. So there's a little bit of a CPI built in there so that the meetings are a little more fair in terms of compensation than the original 6 meetings at $100. Next slide, please. One of the other elements of the Assembly Bill 1234 is expense reimbursement. Again, this now requires a written policy after these statutes were passed. We have that policy at Section 2.6, and it does kind of common sense things for, you know, basically for conferences and meetings that if there's a group rate available, either for transportation or for a hotel, we're encouraged, of course, to use that. And if it's unavailable, it encourages the board to make sure that they consider the expense that's above and beyond the group rate and before approving it. So it's trying to put some common sense limits on expenditures for those types of events. And really, the next slide, please. You'll see that on the reporting requirement, it essentially imposes 2 requirements that we use an expense reporting form that I think Evelyn has the joy of handling on a regular basis with our conferences, and also requires this element of a short report at the next regular meeting. So if you go to AQUA or AWWA or some other conference, you have an obligation to come back to the next regular meeting and do a report. And, of course, in some ways we do that through our committee reports, which is agenda number 5 today. And also under your director comments, you have an opportunity to provide a report. So if this happened to be the meeting in, coming up in mid-May after the May Aqua Conference and you attended, that would be the time that you report that you attended the conference, you know, last week and I sat in on, you know, these, whatever you want to report on whatever conferences you attended. And then what we're talking about today, if you go to the next slide, please, that the statute says that if the agency provides compensation to a director or any member of any legislative body, and it provides for the reimbursement of expenses and provides for a per diem for attendance, then you have to receive this ethical training. And it's at least 2 hours of general ethics principles laws every 2 years. And so that's what we're kind of doing here today. Last slide, please. This is, of course, the negative slide that if it's at all abused or misused, this process, there are consequences. Some are statutory and some are really could be imposed by the board. Like the loss of reimbursement privileges, that could be something that if there's a director who has misused this, the board could institute a policy of not allowing that director to be reimbursed. Or not allowed to attend conferences, those kind of things. And also it could require that there be restitution paid to the agency. There's also some statutory penalties. The reference there to Civil Code Section 8314 is in the Civil Code. It's a civil penalty of $1,000 per day. And then also it adds on 3 times the value of the benefit received. So if you had and unfortunately, I had experience with this where a director rented a rental car for a conference, and it turned out he kept the car for about 2 months. And it was a very unfortunate circumstance. But what the statute says is that if you take the value of that rental car, when it's not used for official business, you multiply it times 3, and that's added to the $1,000 per day penalty. So it could be a substantial penalty. And, of course, the Section 424 of the Penal Code is a penal statute, so it has criminal implications. And that's essentially that statute has to do with embezzlement of public funds. So given the circumstances, one could be alleged to have embezzled public funds if we're in that situation. So that's really the summary of what AB 1234 has enacted, what are they enacted in terms of putting requirements on reporting your expenditures, doing the ethics training, reporting on your attendance conferences, your conference attendance, et cetera. So if we go to the next slide, I just wanted to start talking a little bit about the Brown Act, because I like this slide, because when I first started doing this, I didn't know that the Brown Act was named after someone named Brown, but there he is. It's Ralph M. Brown. He was an assemblyman from the late 50s, I guess, who really wrote the act that we now live with on a daily basis. And, you know, you can see some good policy statements there that the people don't give their public servants the right to decide what is good for the people to know. It's not for them to decide that. And the public's entitled to remain informed about all the public's business, and that's why we have the Brown Act. And as we go through the slides, I think most of you are going to be very familiar with all this stuff. But the whole intent is to promote transparency and to make sure the public is involved. So the next slide, Ben. So the general rule is all meetings of a legislative body or a local agency such as this district shall be open and public, and all persons are permitted to attend. You'll see some of those words are underlined because we're going to define some of those words. And the goals is similar to the previous slide in terms of the policy. Encourage public participation, and to ensure the public's right to attend our meetings. Next slide, please. All right, what's a legislative body? Well, it's pretty simple. Of course, our board is a legislative body. You sit, you convene in public. You have powers and authorities that are vested in you by the California Water Code, and your charge is to make policy. Committees as well are legislative bodies. And we need to draw a distinction here between standing committees and what are called ad hoc committees. Because the Brown Act is very clear that for standing committees that have either continuing subject matter jurisdiction for finance committee or our alleged water policy committees, those have continuing subject matter jurisdiction. Those are standing committees for purposes of the Brown Act, and that means they're subject to the notice requirements that I'm going to get to later. We all recall for a regular meeting, it's a 72-hour notice. For standing committees, we're required to do that. And if you have a meeting that's fixed by charter or ordinance or some of the formal action of this board, that's also a standing committee. And those two conditions generally overlap. We set a calendar for our committee meetings. I'm not sure, when they exactly are, but we have set those by the board's by board action. So those are standing committees that are subject to the Brown Act. And to draw a contrast, sometimes an agency will create what's called ad hoc committees, and they are really committees that are designed for a specific purpose and of limited jurisdiction, usually of limited duration. I often use the example of the Christmas party committee, for example, is a classic ad hoc committee. It's designed for a very specific event. It's only going to be of limited duration, and it's going to go away after that event. That's really not a Brown Act committee. Perhaps a more realistic one might be the district forms a committee to meet on some issue that comes up. We're going to be running a pipeline through a city. We want to meet with the city council representatives on a informal basis for limited duration. Probably be an ad hoc committee that wouldn't be subject to Brown Act notice. So it's a distinction that we need to draw, and sometimes it gets a little confusing. But generally, those rules govern, and standing committees, if they have continuing subject matter jurisdiction and a set schedule or a set schedule, they're going to be Brown Act bodies. Okay. Next slide, Ben. And then this one gets a little kind of squishy too. It's alluding to Director. Director Chavez's comments really about what is a meeting. And a meeting occurs whenever a majority of the members, and of course that's three with our board, congregate at the same time to hear, discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item within the subject matter of this district. So, next slide, please. So we see a lot of different types of meetings. Of course, we have regular meetings, which we're having today, and then there are special meetings that are not used that regularly, but sometimes they come up. If something comes up on short notice and the board president or the general manager perhaps even another board member member brings it to the general manager's attention that the board needs to convene on something pretty quickly. The Brown Act allows you to do that on 24 hours notice. There are limitations on what you can do in a special meeting. You cannot deviate from the agenda. You can only talk about what's on that special meeting agenda. So it's a limited purpose, but it reduces the notice requirement from 72 hours for a regular meeting to 24 hours for a special meeting. And then there are what are called emergency meetings. I've never had experience with an emergency meeting. They really are, by statute, they're designed, and they allow you to call a meeting with no notice when there is an imminent threat to life or property. And it could be, you know, theoretically, it could be a big pipeline blowout or some road getting flooded or something like that, and you guys need to convene right away to authorize some money to fix it, something to that effect. So I've never seen one in place, but they are available if the need comes up. So those are the three primary types of meetings, but of course, regular and special dominate, I think, everybody's agendas in terms of what meetings are called. Next slide, please. You recall from two slides ago that this meeting is defined as any time a majority of the board, of course, three members, get together to talk about district business. There are exceptions to that, and I'm going to walk through those exceptions now because these come up pretty regularly. So individual contacts between two directors, not a meeting. So if Director Santana calls Director Trevino, they have a discussion about some district business, that's not a meeting. You go to a conference, and all three of you sit together at a conference listening to a lecture at Aqua, not a meeting. Community meetings, meetings of other legislative bodies, if you go to a council meeting or a social event, like a ribbon cutting or something like that, that's not a meeting. However, all those last four things I identified, the conference, community meetings, meetings of other legislative bodies, social or ceremonial events, a majority of the board is allowed to attend those, to participate in those, but the one big condition is while you're there, you can't discuss district business. So you can go to a city council meeting to talk about a city council issue. Three of you can go up there and give public testimony, but you can't then go back in the room or somewhere and confer about district business. Same with the social or ceremonial events. It could be a new park opening or something to that effect. You can attend. I'm a director from upper district. All five of you can go, but you can't talk about our district business at that event. If you do that, then you have three of you, at least a majority of you, talking about district business outside of a notice meeting. Going back to the very purpose of the Brown Act, right? If you're going to convene a majority of the board to talk about the district, it has to be open and transparent and available to the public. And in situations like that, it's not this public will not know that you're meeting to do that. So those are the exceptions with that one big condition that you don't discuss amongst yourselves. And the next slide is really just an example that you see, socializing with other board members outside of an open meeting. If three of you decide to go out to dinner, that's fine, but just as long as you don't discuss any district business. That's the same condition I just talked about. Next slide, please. And sometimes we have problems with serial meetings, and it gets a little tricky, and you'll see this slide and the next, I kind of go through the elements of it. But with electronic communications, things get a little muddled more than they used to be. So really, you can't have a meeting where you're talking amongst each other either by phone, by email, et cetera, trying to develop some kind of consensus around a district issue. If there's three of you doing that, then you have a serial meeting because, again, you'd be discussing, a majority of you would be discussing district business, and you wouldn't be making the public wouldn't be making it available for the public to participate. Next slide, please. And so here's how a serial meeting can occur. In-person contacts amongst the majority. If the three of you, after tonight's meeting, three of you stand out in the parking lot and start talking about something that happened tonight or you want to see it on the next agenda, that would be prohibited, right? That would be a majority of you talking outside of a notice meeting. And then technological contacts with telephone, fax, email chains, et cetera. that can get pretty sticky. And there's a couple of recent events that I think are worth noting. There was a case a few years ago from the California Supreme Court concerning the city of San Jose, where city of San Jose employees and council members had personal phone devices, and they were communicating about city business with staff and with other council members on their personal phone. And there was a Public Records Act request for any communications between the council members. So the issue became, are the city council's texts and phone call messages, are those public records for purposes of the Brown Act? For purposes of the Public Records Act. And get into the weeds a little bit, the Public Records Act broadly defines a public record in California. It basically says any record of any form, be it paper, electronic, et cetera, that is owned and maintained by the public agency, and it relates to the public agency's business, it's a public record. So someone sent in a Public Record Act to the city of San Jose. They say, we'd like to see all this communication. The city responded, we don't have that. That's not owned by us because it's on their personal devices. This was litigated up to the California Supreme Court, and the California Supreme Court said that, in fact, is public information, even though it's on their private phones. So texting, phone messaging, et cetera, that is now considered to be available for discovery under the Public Records Act. And, you know, this is one of those situations where the law is finally catching up to technology. Another example of this is something called mass mailings, where the FPPC has rulings that prevent any of the directors, any of the elected officials from being what's called featured in a mass mailing, where if something went out and the district paid for it, and it has to be, it's a very low threshold, it has to be more than, I think, $100 in costs, and it goes out to more than 200 people, and if one of you is featured on it, that's an improper expenditure of public funds because it's featuring one person with public money, right? Well, the definition of mass mailing is a letter or something that's physically handed out. It doesn't apply to electronic communication. It's still crazy that the FPPC hasn't caught up to that yet, but it's an example of the technology hasn't caught up yet. In this case, in some ways it has, because the court recognized that everybody's personal devices are used for everything. Ideally, every one of you would have two phones, one for district business and one for your personal life, but I have not seen that happen yet. So anyway, that's one of the technological issues with serial meetings. And then there's the two classic ones, which you've probably heard about before, with the daisy chain and the hub and spoke serial meetings. That would be where one director contacts another director, and then that second director contacts yet a third director, and you're all talking about the same thing, trying to develop some kind of collective consensus or agreement on an issue. That's prohibited. That is a serial meeting, and it's done outside the context of a notice meeting, so thus it's a Brown Act violation. And then hub and spoke. That would be, for example, if your general manager started calling you individually, trying to get you all to agree on an issue outside of a public meeting, that would be yet another Brown Act violation. So we have to be careful of that.
So I have a question, if I may. Actually, I have a whole bunch of questions, but I'm biting my tongue here. I don't want to be.
That kind of wraps up the meeting-related stuff, so maybe it's a good time to break now.
Okay, so with the meeting, so three members to avoid the Brown Act should not be discussing district business. So if there's three members at a luncheon table, mm-hmm. and someone across says, "Hey, so what's new at the upper district?" Well, one director says, "Well, we're doing this new project," and the other director says, "Oh yeah, it's a great project," and a third director. They're all discussing district business. Is that a violation? Yeah. Because the intent is having a discussion and then rendering a decision, which is a no-no. So can you address just that?
Well, you're identifying by just you're saying you're just responding to a question. And you're not trying to develop a concurrence amongst the three of you,
right?
They're saying, yeah, it's tricky. My advice would be, you tell that person, you know what? There's three of us here. This could be considered to be a Brown Act meeting if I'm discussing district business, so I'd prefer not to answer that. I can answer that later when I'm out of the presence of my other directors. That would be the safest answer. But generally, the cases have looked at when there's really, and I keep using this term because it's used in the cases, an attempt to develop a collective concurrence, you know, to try and get three votes on something. But I tend to be conservative in this advice because it just saves you and the district any exposure to anyone coming back and, you know, some reporter or someone coming back and saying that, you know, they were at this luncheon discussing district business outside of a notice meeting.
And since we're on serial meetings, so let's say there's one director that's trying to get a consensus on an issue and using a serial meeting to do so. However, that director talks to me one-on-one and I give them my opinion, or yes, I would vote for it, I won't. And for me, that's the only communication I know of. That director goes to another director and they're unaware that they talk to me and they're just talking amongst themselves. Still a serial meeting, still a violation, but I didn't know that person talked to a second one or used my information to send it to another director. And then that third director had no idea. They thought they were just talking amongst themselves.
Right.
So can you get a little clarification on that?
Sure. In that situation, you would be a kind of an innocent participant in this. And whoever that that director kind of who was operating this whole operation, of course, mm-hmm. they'd be the culpable one.
Mm-hmm.
However, it wouldn't, in terms of individual exposure, I would think you'd not have any issues. But the one, excuse me, who's instigating would certainly. And more importantly, whatever action you've taken as a board because of that improper serial meeting would be void. So if you approved a contract for a pipeline, you approved anything of any district business, that would be a void action. It would either have to be, probably have to be brought back and done again. So, I see your point in that situation. You wouldn't have known, not necessarily have known that. So I think if this was in a practical world, you'd probably be okay.
Okay.
But, you know, it's in a practical world. Like if I was sitting at DA's desk and I got this report and say, well, this guy didn't know, he's not going to get charged with anything. But that's not going to stop a reporter, perhaps, and just claiming, oh, the Upper District had a Brown Act violation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we're all pretty conscious of that.
Okay.
So that's where we kind of finish up on the kind of the serial meeting aspect of it. If we go to the next item, really is getting into more like agenda items that come up. And, of course, consistent with the Brown Act policy of transparency, you can't take action on anything that's not listed on the agenda except in limited circumstances. So I'm going to turn now to those limited circumstances. Next slide, please. So you are allowed, however, to give brief responses. So if we had public comment, someone asks you about, hey, when's the water fest or something like that, you could respond to that, to brief questions from the public. So because you're doing it at a public meeting, if something comes up where you're asked a meeting, you can ask your staff to clarify something. We had an example of that tonight at this meeting with Tom asking staff for some clarity on one of the appointments. And if there's a staff report that raises an issue, and you can also tell the staff to bring something back at a future meeting. So you're not up here with bound and gagged. You can respond to issues that come up from the public. But as to the agenda, if you go to the next slide, there are really two situations that arise that allow you to come up and have a discussion on something that's not on the agenda. And first one is under an emergency situation. And this is a little distinct from what I talked about earlier with calling an emergency meeting. This is a situation where the agenda is posted and something happens that you need to talk about right away. And so you can see it's a pretty dire circumstance that's described in the statute. Really kind of a disaster or some kind of large destruction of infrastructure, a terrorist act, example, and then something that's threatening public health or safety. So in that situation, you can put something on the agenda. And we do that at the beginning of the meeting, saying we have this situation, we really need to talk about this. We make a finding that it's a sufficient emergency to get on the agenda under the statutory scheme, and then you can agendize it and then discuss it. The next one is kind of more commonly used because the emergency definition is really for drastic circumstances. There's this another one that's allowed where you can add something to the agenda after the agenda has been posted because an immediate need to take action arose. So it's frankly, it's a little bit of a lesser standard than the emergency situation. And I think we've used that a few times in the past, that the need to take action arose and came to the attention of the district after the agenda was posted. So because you have a pretty substantial notice period of 72 hours, in those 3 days, is that 3 days? I think it's 3 days, right? In those 3 days, something could come up where it really warrants your attention. It could be like something that could have a severe financial impact to the district, for example. You need to sell some bonds, or you need to take a position on something. You're allowed to add that to the agenda, but it has to be with a two-thirds vote. And if one of you is missing, it has to be unanimous. So they tried to make it a pretty high standard to get it put on the agenda. And that's essentially like the emergency thing. It's a two-step process. The first one would be you make a finding that the need to take action exists and that it arose after the agenda, and then it gets on the agenda, and then the second step would be to act on it once it's on the agenda. So those are the kind of the exceptions to acting on things that aren't on the agenda. Next slide, please. No surprise here, the agenda, it's essential to give the public notice. And you have to provide a pretty brief general description of the matters to be discussed or considered. And the Brown Act also says you can do it in as little as 20 words. So it doesn't have to be a big in-depth report. It just has to give the public reasonable notice about what you're talking about. Not a surprise there. Next slide. On the posting requirements, I've kind of hit on this already. On the regular meetings, it's 72 hours. And on special meetings, it's 24 hours. And again, on the special meetings, you can't do what we just talked about on dealing with things that aren't on the agenda. So if we called a special meeting on 24 hours notice, something came up within that 24-hour period after the special meeting agenda had been posted and we convened the meeting, you can't add anything to a special meeting agenda. You can do it on a regular meeting, but you can't add it to a special meeting agenda. Next slide, please. As you know, I think we've talked about this several times in the last couple of years. I've managed to put you all to sleep, I think, on several occasions presenting on this. But basically, we still have the two ways to get some to attend remotely: the Assembly Bill 2449, which is the just cause finding that's required, and then the original 54953, which is really set forth on this slide. That you have to make wherever you are remotely has to be available to the public. That location has to be posted, and you have to let the public participate from that remote location. And we have to act by roll call. Next slide, please. Nothing new here. This is just the essentially public comment has to be allowed at the beginning of the meeting for things on the agenda, and of course before the body takes action on anything, the public is allowed to comment on that as well. So it's pretty straightforward. Next slide, please. Closed sessions. I know we've been fortunate. We hadn't had to call many closed sessions in the past year or so. But as you know, I think from all your experience, we've been through all these. If you look at that second bullet, they're most commonly used for personnel issues, litigation, labor negotiations, which is really not an issue here. We don't have any represented employees, and real property acquisitions. Again, this is the Brown Act allows you to have these executive or closed sessions because these are sensitive items that, if they were open in public, would probably not inure to the benefit of the agency. So it allows for discussion behind closed doors on these specified matters. And, of course, because of that, disclosure of this information is prohibited. If the body itself decides to divulge some information, it can, because it's the agency that holds the privilege. However, individual directors are not to disclose anything from closed sessions. And I have the, you know, the consequences in there. It could be, if it's an employee doing so, there could be discipline. Someone could obtain injunctive release against a director who plans to release closed session information, or it could result in a grand jury discussion or investigation of that. Next slide, please. These are the, it's a little technical, but it walks through the statutes that talk about the what we're allowed to do under existing litigation, anticipated and initiating litigation, and then unemployment and discipline matters. It's the statutes that allow us to do that. One note on this, and I know, I think you probably all know this, but you can have a discussion of someone's employment in closed session, but the Brown Act is very clear that if you're going to talk about money, if you're going to talk about compensation, we have to do that in open session. And so oftentimes that discussion of performance, it oftentimes implicates compensation, either to reward the employee whose performance you're discussing. You can have those discussions, but if you're going to act on someone's salary, it's very clear for executive officers like your general manager, that action has to be in open session. So we have to take it out and vote on his salary in open session. And of course, we've been doing that for every time we adjust Tom's salary, I think. Next slide, please. If we're negotiating for real property, the agenda has to include certain things about what's being discussed and who our negotiator is. Next slide, please. Again, this is a little repetitive of what we alluded to earlier, but if you're going to disclose closed session communications, that is a prohibited activity. And winding up on the next slide, please, under violations, if you have kind of a look at Director Chavez's example before, if someone was intentionally in creating a serial meeting, that potentially could be charged as a criminal action as a misdemeanor. And also, the district attorney can actually take civil action as well to prevent a future violation. That would likely be in terms of an injunction of some kind. And then if that, Director Chavez, using your example, if that happened, if there was a serial meeting, we have time to cure it. So if the meeting you described was saying approving some contract, that contract would be void because of the serial meeting, but we'd have time to come back and cure that. We could put the contract back on another agenda and approve it appropriately, and that cures the violation. And last slide, again, just more policy language about what the Brown Act is intended to do in terms of openness, transparency, and public access. And that kind of winds up the first half of this presentation on Brown Act, and I'll stop there for any discussion or questions.
Thank you, Steve. Do we have discussion, any additional questions? Yes.
Steve, in all your years of being a lawyer, have you ever seen any cases where someone has been punished for divulging things in closed session?
Yes. There was, at another agency, a director did divulge some closed session matters, and the rest of the board's decision was to censure that director. And a censure is essentially a motion by the other directors, and it's defined as a public show of disapproval. So it was a slap on the hand. It wasn't, the decision was made not to refer it to the DA's office or to anyone else, to keep it internal and censure that director. But that's one time in more of the years than I'd like to count.
We had one at the Met. It's a classic one. When we were doing a closed session on who the new GM would be, interviews. Within 50 seconds or 30 seconds, I should say, this phone started pinging, and somebody in that room divulged all this information. You know,
it's
amazing.
It's not helpful.
So, if I may, so the recent example of closed session information getting leaked out was the mayor of Anaheim. They were negotiating the stadium there, and he received personal or or some confidential information and took it to the owners of the stadium and made his own negotiations with them. And I think he's serving time right now.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, when was that? What year was that?
It was just last year, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. The former mayor of Anaheim.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's grounded in the kind of a little bit of the weeds. It's grounded in the attorney-client privilege, right? We're having a discussion in closed session, and so it's important to realize that the client, my client, is not Director Chavez, it's not Director Trino, it's not Tom Love, it's the agency. And so the agency holds the privilege, and the agency can make a determination to disclose something, but that would require three votes, and not one of you have three votes. You all have one vote, right? So it's really important that if this is we're having a discussion in there, and you think that's, you know, the public could benefit by you know, talking about some of this information, that would require a majority vote to do that. But you'll see in some circumstances, for example, if we're settling litigation, we have an obligation to, once the litigation settles, we have to announce the terms of the settlement because the public's entitled to know, especially if we're paying money. The public's entitled to know what we're doing with their funds. But as a general rule, you know, it's not good practice, to say the least, to disclose any closed session discussions.
Thank you.
So with that, I'll turn to the next slide and the next kind of subject matter, and this is, I'm going to run through, and I think most of you have probably heard about these issues before, conflicts of interest, and they're really defined in two sets of statutes, the Political Reform Act and Government's Code Section 1090. And just to go back one more time, Ben, the best way to think about this is when you look at Government Code Section 1090, it's a more limited application of the conflicts doctrine, and it has to do with contracting. It's very specific to public contracting as it applies to upper district. Political Reform Act is kind of a broader application. It apply to every kind of non-contractual decision that a board like this could make. But now we can go to the next slide. And this is kind of repeating what I just talked about. With public agency lawyers like myself, who's my client? Well, the state bar sets forth rules of professional conduct for lawyers. And it's very clear that the agency is the client, the organization itself acting through its directors. So it's not individuals. It's always the body itself who's the client. So if we go to the next slide, please. So the Political Reform Act. And this is really generally, it was set forth originally in 1974. That's when the first Political Reform Act was passed in California. And it came out of I wasn't around in California then, but I think it came out of some concern with public directors and self-dealing. I mean, the whole intent of this is to prevent any kind of self-dealing. And there's kind of a basic test, that first bullet that you read, that a public official may not participate or even influence a governmental decision that will have a reasonable and material financial effect on the official or the official's immediate family, or any of the officials' economic interests. And the interests include such things as real property, sources of employment, if the official owns any business entities, et cetera. And it's a pretty broad application, too. It doesn't apply just to voting. It applies to participating in deliberations. So if you think you have a conflict and you attend a meeting and you engage in the deliberations but say, oh, I'm not going to vote on this because I have a conflict, you'll learn later in this presentation that's not allowed. You can't even vote on it or participate in any deliberations concerning the matter. And thus you'll see that last bullet, even talking with another board member, if you do have a conflict, that's prohibited, just even having a discussion with another board member, because that could be considered to be a participation in the process. And next slide, please. And this is another kind of restatement of the original first bullet on the prior slide. And we're going to go through some of these definitions that are contained in these steps. But is it reasonably foreseeable that it's going to have a financial impact on any of the officials? Is it going to be foreseeable that effect is going to be material? Is it going to, and you'll see what's not material later on. And then you'll see that this concept of the effect on the public generally comes up. And basically what's behind that is if something's occurring as a result of a district action that's occurring to you that is having the same effect on the public generally, then you're not getting into any advantage and there's no self-dealing interest there. So that's going to be okay. And so, again, if there's a conflict, you cannot participate. So the way this is set up is that you have the Political Reform Act in the statutes in Government Code Section 81,000, and it goes through there's a lot of statutes. But there's also the FPPC has set up regulations that kind of interpret the statutes that give you certain definitions. And so next slide, please. So here's some of the economic interest, because remember what we're talking about here is what the official's economic interest is in the decision. So if you receive, the first one is a very common one, the sources of income for all of you directors. If you receive $500 or more in income from any one source, you're going to have an economic interest in the decision. And it could be from your employer, for a nonprofit, if you have interest in another business entity, or if someone is giving you money, that could be an economic interest as defined under sources of income. And then personal finances has to do with not only you, but any personal interests in, financial interests in your immediate family, and with a spouse, a domestic partner, or your children. If you had a real property interest, when the interest is worth $2,000 or more, which of course we know is a pretty low threshold for real property interest in this neighborhood, that could create an economic interest that you have to be careful about. If you have any investment interest in a business, that could trigger an economic interest. Or if you have a management position or as a trustee or even an employee in a management position with someone who's doing business with the district, that could be an issue. So there's a lot behind this, and I'd urge all of you, if something comes up and you have an issue that you think could be implicated by one of these economic interests, these are the most common ones. There are others. But just check in with Tom and I as early as possible, because it's a pretty sticky area. It gets a little dense, but it's important that we make sure that we don't have any situations where someone has a conflict of interest and it's the 5 minutes before the board meeting and they come to us and say, what should I do? It's something we'd like to know about in advance. I have another agency that's in the Inland Empire that has a lot of still a lot of development going on out there, and I have a board member who's involved in the development world. So before every board meeting, we go through the agenda with him, and we try to identify, this is D.B. Horton, and here's another big home builder. Do you have any issues with them? And he lets me know when he does, and then we organize it so that you'll see there's a process that he steps out for those votes and doesn't participate. So we haven't really had any issues here that I know of, but it's something to be aware of. Next slide, please. And so let's say that something comes up when and you do have an economic interest that could have a material financial effect on you, and you realize, I got a conflict. Well, what do we do? Well, you have to, at the board meeting, we have to publicly identify that interest. So it could either be the director himself, or I or Tom could do it. We just want to get it on the record that, you know, Director A has a conflict, a potential conflict, because of this interest. Of course, that director has to refrain from participating or even discussing the matter. And then that director has to get up and physically leave the dais and leave the, essentially, you could probably go back into the conference room for that decision. And then when it's voted on, the minutes should reflect that director has left the room. And what often comes up is it could be on a consent calendar. And so if we know in advance, we'll get that item pulled, or the director, his or herself, could have that item pulled from the consent calendar and say, I got to pull this because I could have a conflict. Could move the rest of the consent calendar, but that one we put to the side, and then we'll take that separately so the director could recuse his or herself from the vote. Next slide, please. And now we're getting into the Section 1090, which has to do with more straight contract issues. And you'll see the statute itself there. I put the whole statute up just so you can read it. And it has to do with the fact that no member of the legislature or any other body, frankly, can have a financial interest in any contract made by them in their official capacity. It makes sense, right? I mean, we want to make sure that everybody has an unbiased view, an unvarnished view of the contracts that the district approves, and that we don't want to have anyone having an interest in any of those contracts. And so next slide, please. That first bullet is really a policy statement about that from anyone having an economic interest. And again, I kind of restated that section of the statute that talks about their contracts. And like in the Political Reform Act, it's not just voting on the contract that matters. It's anything leading up to that, any kind of preliminary discussions, any negotiations or planning, et cetera, are prohibited by that by the statute. Next slide, please. And so it's a little different than the Political Reform Act in the sense that we can't even enter into the contract. You remember, and you'll see later on, there's one limited exception when the district could enter into a contract where someone has what's called a remote or non-interest. But if if there is a contract where a director has a true conflict, it's not like that director, if he has a direct interest in that contract, it's not a situation where the director can leave the room and then we approve the contract. We can't approve the contract, period. You'll see, however, there's an exception to that that I'll get to a little later. But disqualification for a direct conflict is not allowed. It's just it's prohibited. And it's there's been a couple of cases because it's a pretty drastic remedy where if you have a 1090 violation, the contract is declared void. Whoever is on the other side of the contract from the district doesn't get their money back. It's called void ab initio, meaning the contract was void at inception. So if we had a contract to install a pipeline that was found to be void because of 1090, we could still use that pipeline, but the contractor really gets nothing out of it. They don't get paid. If they do get paid, they owe the money back. So it's a pretty drastic remedy. So it's a very severe remedy because of the policy interest in not having directors involved on having a financial involvement in a contract. And so if you can go to the next slide, this is where it gets a little technical because we have to discuss a direct or indirect financial interest. And basically, a direct interest is when the official is the party who's contracting with the agency. If Director Chavez has a paving company and we want to repave a pipeline dig that we put in and we awarded the contract to his company, that would be a direct interest. If there is an indirect interest, however, it gets a little wider, and that's defined as an official who has a financial relationship with the contracting party or who will receive some benefit from the making of the contract with the contract party. So, you know, if we have a situation where someone's perhaps has a relative working for a contractor that we contract with, that could be an indirect financial interest and could implicate and trigger the statute. And interestingly, this it doesn't matter if the contract is going to have a negative effect or a positive effect on the contractor. It's a the fact that there is an influence and an involved board member makes it a violation of 1090. And then a little bit more in the weeds. Next slide, please. And so there are limited exceptions. And one of them is called the non-interest exception. And that's when the interest is so small that the legislature had determined they really don't matter. And that's this kind of public generally exception, where the director receives the same services provided by the director's agency on the same terms as they're provided to the public. For example, a water district board member, you can set the terms and the rates for water service, and you know, you're directly involved with that discussion, you're a direct beneficiary of that decision, but because the whole public that's in your jurisdiction is being treated the same, you're being treated the same as the public generally, so it's not an interest. It's a non-interest. And then there's some examples. Next slide, please. Under the remote interest exception. And these are definitions that are in the regulations that define people who have remote interest. For example, if you're an employee of the contracting party and you've been an employee for at least 3 years prior assuming office, you're determined to have a remote interest. Or if you're a supplier of goods and you've been doing that for 5 years before assuming office, you're determined to have a remote interest. And in those situations, and there's others, these are just some examples, but there are others, but in situations, you can have the disqualification process. You can leave the room and the board can act on the contract, because the policy behind that is, well, this was going on well before you took office, and thus there's a conclusion by the legislature that you're not in here for self-dealing, that you had there was a pre-existing relationship. And next slide, please. This is kind of interesting about reliance on counsel. And this goes back to the beginning of this presentation where the situation was my client is actually the district and not the individual directors. And there was a California Supreme Court case concerning a city council member who, while he was on the city council, he got the council to approve a contract with him to become the city manager. Right? You talk about a direct interest. I mean, it's right there, right? So he becomes the city manager through a virtue of a contract with the agency. And he said, well, I talked to the city attorney. The city attorney said it was okay. Well, the city attorney had his head up, you know, where, and by giving that advice. And Supreme Court said, you can't rely on counsel for advice as a defense to this. That contract is void. You need to pay back the money the city has paid you, and you're no longer the city attorney. So I apologize for the typo, I just saw that. Relying on improper advice of counsel is not a defense, and relying on proper advice of counsel is not a defense. You have to be aware of that. And I'm not saying don't talk to me about these issues. Please, I encourage you to do that. But just be aware that if it's something that's very serious and there could be criminal exposure, I'll probably tell you to, really, you need to go talk to a lawyer who's not me. You need to get your own counsel for something like this. And that's, frankly, it's come up only a few times in my practice, but unfortunately it has come up. And that's the advice I have to give, because I'm not your attorney. But in the interest of the district, my client, I can give you some advice to help the district out on this issue. So there's a fine line there. But hopefully we'll never get there, and I don't anticipate seeing that. For violations of Section 1090, I've alluded to these a little bit already. The contract is void. The agency doesn't have to pay for any of the goods or services that it received, and it can seek reimbursement for what it was paid. And also, it could be a criminal penalty. And it depends if it just went to a district attorney's office, how they wanted to file it. But I've seen this attempted before, where they try to disqualify someone from ever holding office. And it gets a little tricky, but it comes down to whether or not what they did was called determined to be a crime of moral turpitude, which is a crime of deceit. Was there intentional deceit involved in the action? If that's the case, someone could be disqualified from holding office moving forward. So 1090 is very doesn't happen that often, but it has very drastic remedies. It's a very serious set of statutes. And if you have any questions, make sure you come check in with Tom or I if something like this comes up. Next slide, please. Something that comes up pretty regularly is gift limits. This is, again, these are in the FPPC regulations. That's that code section at the end, the 2 CCR, which is California Code of Regulations. These were established by the FPPC to interpret some of the Political Reform Act statutes. But you cannot accept gifts from a single source in a calendar year in excess of certain limits. They reset the limits every 2 years. And right now that limit is $590. So you can't accept more than $590 from a single source in a calendar year. Okay. If you accept any gifts, next slide. Any gifts you exceed, excuse me, you accept that exceed $50, those have to be disclosed on your Form 700s. So you think about it in two ways. Anything below $50, if someone gives you a ticket to something that's less than $50, that's not reportable. If it's over $50, you have it reported. And then your ceiling is $590, which is probably the price of two Clipper tickets these days. But anyway, those are important because they do come up. And in a related matter, next slide, we have this Assembly Bill 1439, which was effective most recently, January last year, and it amends the government code concerning contributions to elected bodies. And it arose from, this 8438 arose in 1992. There were some issues that were before some coastal commissioners who were appointed commissioners. They're not elected. And it turned out they received some pretty large contributions from some people with property interests before, who had business before the commission. And, you know, that didn't look good or didn't smell good. And so that's how that statute came about. And then in 2022, the legislature really kind of expanded that and extended it to, next slide, please, Ben. They extended it to members of elected bodies, including a district like this. And if someone has received a campaign contribution of $250 or more within the preceding 12 months, that director is required to recuse herself or himself from voting on a matter involving the issues here, license, contract, or permit, which, as you'll see in the next slide, has a very broad application. It's essentially all contracts. So that's really the kind of a recent expansion of the limitations on contributions. And I think the next slide winds it up with any questions. So that kind of winds up the section on conflicts. So we reviewed the Political Reform Act, the kind of the non-contractual conflicts, and then 1090, which has to do specifically with contracts and those types of services. So at this point, I'll entertain any questions, of course.
All right, do we have any questions for Steve? Okay, seeing none.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And next time it'll be more. I'm sorry.
I believe we do have a question from the audience.
Ask your own attorney the question.
you got another hour to go. That's 2 hours. But on that, okay, good.
Yeah,
I actually do have a question and a scenario. So you know, forgive me for asking a lot of questions. I asked a lot of questions too 19 years ago when I voted for this, when I was a member of the state legislature in 2005. Mm. Steve. So usually this will happen on a city council. So a council member or elected official cannot vote on matter if it affects their income, positive or negative as well.
Right.
So what would happen on the scenario where a council member owns a house and they're going to build an abortion clinic right next door, and he feels that his property value will go down because of that. However, he argues that that person is going to vote against it because of religious purposes. It's offensive to that council member. So can they vote, or should they? I would not vote for it, but.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, one of the things I didn't have, it's not included in the slide because it's way deep in the weeds, but the FPPC regs talk about, I think it's a 500-foot radius. If there's any property within that 500-foot radius, that's determined to be an effect on your real estate interest, mm-hmm. and you'd be prohibited from voting.
So in smaller cities, Irwindale, City of Industry, where everybody lives in the same block, sometimes they have to draw straws if there's a conflict within two or three other members, and the council still has a vote on these matters.
Yeah.
Can you kind of explain that?
There's a seldom used thing called the rule of necessity,
mm-hmm.
when so many, if a majority of the body has a conflict, they have to explain that, and also have to explain that the body can't act because of this conflict, so they have to excuse these conflict rules to allow them to proceed under the rule of necessity. I don't think I've ever seen it used, but it's there. So frankly, I'm not that familiar with the process for the rule of necessity, but that doctrine exists that if everyone or a quorum is conflicted, they can excuse the prohibitions because the agency has to do its business.
Right.
If the example would be if all five council members live in the same block where they needed to run a sewer line, not all of them can abstain because then they wouldn't be able to complete their project. So that's an extreme example, but it does exist.
Right.
Okay. Wow. Great, trustee.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. And does this so this satisfies our ethics training for the year or half of it?
At the end of all this, we'll wrap up. Did I do 30 minutes?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was an hour? Oh, my God. I'm so sorry.
Vanessa timed it.
It was 2 hours.
2 hours.
Next time I'll bring coffee for everybody.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Steve. That was item 7E, ethics overview. We'll move on to that. Wraps up our action items, discussion items for today. We'll go on to item 8, which is information items. We have press releases and news articles in our packet. Took a look at those, and it's all looks like they're all related to the Delta. Looks like there's some interesting news on that.
Good news on the Delta conveyance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Next up, Stephen O'Neill, we have attorney's report.
Sure, this will only take about 40 minutes.
Part two.
No, worked on some contracts with Evelyn and staff concerning the turf transformation project, the elevator contract, of course, and then prepared some of these slides for today.
Thank you very much. All right, engineer's report, Steve Johnson.
Thank you, Madam President, and good evening to everybody. I apologize for missing the last meeting, by the way. I don't know if the President was here or not, because you were kind of busy.
Virtually,
yeah. Anyway, pretty short report on the engineering side. There is a report in the packet, so you have that. Key well elevation is at 222.8. It's dropping. It's dropped 0.4 of a foot this last week. It's dropped almost 2 feet from the prior month. The spreading rounds are dry, and we're pumping, so it's normal for it to be dropping right now. It did peak out at about 232, 233, so it's down about 10 feet from our high. We had great recovery. If you look at the graph, we had great recovery this year, but we were way down there when we started it, so we didn't get to an elevation that we were comfortable with, and we're still not there. So it's interesting. We had a little rain this weekend, and I think there is an atmospheric river coming on Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. It's supposed to rain most of the week, so that's all good. Interesting that, and I think General Ranger Thomas reported in the past, in the previous meetings, you recall these letter agreements we had with MWD for them to put water in cyclic storage, and then we'd pay for it over time with the RDA assessment, Water Master would. I frankly would not have believed this would have happened, but all that water has now been purchased. There's no water. All that water that MWD put in advance under letter agreements, we have paid for a third of it or a fifth of it, a year. It's all been paid for. So we have no MWD water agency, Water Master operator. We have no water in cyclic storage. We're trying to get some water in cyclic storage, but there is no water there right now. With the State Water Project entitlement at 10%, MWE cannot put, unless the general manager were to override that, cannot put water into replenishment programs. So we'll be looking for water. Hopefully, these storms will increase the State Water Project entitlement, and we'll see some imported water. So that's kind of where we're at. These storms have had an effect. Inflow to San Gabriel Reservoir As of just yesterday, it's up to almost 150 CFS. That's pretty good. So we've got a saturated watershed. When it does rain like this, we're going to see runoff. We've picked up some storage in the canyon. We were down around 12 or 13,000 acre feet. Minimum pool is about 10. We're up over 20,000 right now. And as I mentioned, at 150 CFS, we're getting 300 acre feet a day in storage. So we are building up some local water. Hopefully they'll get the spreading grounds all cleaned up. The goal was by the end of January, which is really just next week. And we'll have them available to put some water into our spreading grounds and start building some water back into storage. So that's kind of where we're at. Rainfall, recall we had the Hurricane Hillary that added some water into this fiscal year's rainfall, which made it kind of odd because we were operating at, you know, hundreds of percent past the long-term average just because of that storm. Well, it's caught up now. And as of a couple of days ago, January 22nd, for this fiscal year, in Puddingstone, we're now down to 74% of long-term average. So it's caught up now. We're behind. And in San Gabriel Dam, it's 91% of long-term average. So we are behind long-term average, even with the big July storm that we had. I think there's some discussion I'm sure Tom's going to want to have on the spreading grounds and what's going on there, what we're trying to do on the State Water Project entitlement. For water quality, we did sample 8 water master under Title 22 program under administrative assessment. Sampled 8 wells in December, and in November, 71 wells were sampled. There were no new wells sampled as a result of a new water quality issue. And in interest to the Madam President, I know it's an interest. We do have the memo on the PFAS results. We are working our way through it. It was prepared for the water master for the producers. Producers haven't really gotten it back yet. Water master wanted to send it to EPA because EPA had an interest in it. EPA had some comments. They want some additional reporting done. They're requesting it. And the water master right now is working with the because a lot of it's related, all of his interest is related to EPA representatives, Wayne Praskin, who's the project manager for EPA on the Baldwin Park operable unit. And what he's asking for is more information on the impact of PFAS to the Baldwin Park operable unit. So water master is coming back to, with the information from EPA, coming back to the responsible parties in the Baldwin Park operable unit and telling them that EPA is asking for this, you guys have to pay for it. So that's where we're at right now to get the memo finalized. As soon as that gets done, it'll be released to the public, and I think it's on the a future agenda to make a presentation here on PFAS in the basin. And I think that's all I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mm-hmm. Any questions for the engineer? Comments? Okay. Thank you, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. General Manager's Report.
I've got a number of things to just quickly brief the board on. And kind of on to what Steve said, there is a 10% allocation. Metropolitan, under their storage policy, they typically don't deliver into cyclic storage programs unless their total storage balance shows that they're going to be putting more water into storage than taking it out. And that's not the situation until that allocation increases. But it doesn't mean they will not make firm service deliveries. So they will make firm service deliveries to replenishment. And all that means is if you do a cyclic delivery, you pay for it later. If you do a firm service delivery, they will invoice you as soon as that water is delivered and you pay that invoice. Given that, the board last year, near the end of the year, authorized me to purchase 10,000 acre feet of water. The intent at that time was to purchase that from the Metropolitan Cyclic account. But after Water Master's purchases, there was only about 3,900 acre feet left. So of that 10,000 authorization, there's still 6,000 acre feet. I do intend, if conditions are right and the spreading facilities are available, sometime between now and the end of April, is calling on Met to deliver that 6,000 acre feet of water. But in addition to that, Metropolitan has indicated that they may be able to get a little bit of extra water specifically for groundwater replenishment. Even if the allocation is still at 10%, if this extra water comes in, they will make it as a cyclic delivery. And that is between 9 and 14,000 acre feet. So it looks like we could possibly deliver 6 to 20,000 acre feet to the spreading grounds this spring over the next couple of months. Again, that depends on dry conditions. If it starts raining, if the it rains next week, like Steve said, and that continues, obviously the spreading grounds and all the recharge facilities will be putting local water into the ground. There won't be room for imported water. But we'll work forward on that. The other thing is on Tuesday, we do this, I think it's a once a quarter, it's a groundwater recharge coordinating committee with all the entities along the San Gabriel River, including the water replenishment district to the south. And I know this was of interest to the board a few months ago, but the county has been, they give us reports on all their maintenance they're doing on their facilities. And as we know, since the Bobcat Fire, and the county started this in 2021, they started a sediment clean out of Cogswell Reservoir and San Gabriel Reservoir from all that sediment and debris that were in those reservoirs. And I want to give you some statistics. And these are multi-year projects. So at Cogswell, they originally thought it would take 3 years. Now it's going to take 4 years. They issued a contract for $95 million, and they're removing, so far they've removed 1.4 million cubic yards of material from Cogswell, the little one. That's the little one. San Gabriel Reservoir, they estimate 4.9 million cubic yards of material, a five-year project. The original contract was $142 million. It is now $160 million. And so far, they've barely dented it, 1.3 million cubic yards of material. But they are continuing the work. And so every after the rainy year, you know, they use the reservoirs for water storage. And then when that water is delivered to the replenishment facilities, they draw down the water in those two reservoirs, and they send in the construction equipment to start mucking out the material. But I thought that was interesting, and the board might be curious to know what was going on there up in the canyon. Also on water resources, MWD is going to have a shutdown of the upper feeder. That is the treated water pipeline that runs between Laverne all the way over to La Cañada, their Eagle Rock Operations Center. And that will affect three of our connections, the one for Monrovia, the one for Arcadia, and then all the way down on the Palo Verde feeder is South Pasadena. Monrovia has not used their connection for some time. They are not impacted. But Arcadia and South Pasadena, I've notified them of the shutdown. They were participated in a coordination meeting on Tuesday, and they're preparing their system for a shutdown from February 5th to 14th. These shutdowns, unless it's an emergency, they are scheduled shutdowns for maintenance and improvements on Met's distribution system, are always scheduled in the wintertime when it's cooler and wetter and water demands are at their lowest, so that agencies are able to go without their Met deliveries for a period of time while they conduct it. South Pasadena and Arcadia are saying they don't see any issues with a shutdown going forward. Quick updates on the building. Obviously, the elevator works. You guys all experienced that today. They just got a couple of cosmetic things that they still need to wrap up on it. EV chargers are installed. The ones under the building are active. The ones out in the public area need some software configuration before they'll be available for use. And we will set those up. The public chargers will be available on a pay-for-charge basis. We're not going to give away the power for free. It'll be a pay, and it'll be based on how much it costs us for the electricity. I'll skip the USG improvements and some of that work. We'll report that at the Water Resources Committee a little later on. But Steve mentioned the purchase by Watermaster. We received the Met invoice. It's over $40 million worth of water that's being purchased with that December invoice. We received the invoice for December on January 10th, and we have, 45 days to pay Met? So we invoice Watermaster and do the cash flow on it. While Watermaster will pay us that invoice, most of it's going to go back to Metropolitan. So we only keep our surcharge on that amount of water. The other thing I want the directors to know we're working on is as we looked at our maps and started to compare our district boundaries and with Three Valleys, there's some areas where either our boundaries don't coincide or they overlap. And so there's minor modifications that we will need to make. Those boundaries should align. So we're working with Three Valleys and some consultants to review those, prepare exhibits, and information, and eventually go through a LAFCO process to approve the boundary changes so they line up. Lastly, tomorrow we have a nice event over at the is it the mining company, Mining Company Women in Water, I'll leave it a surprise for the special honoree, but she's sitting in the room.
Tom, can I ask you a question I asked you once before? What do they do with all the stuff they're removing from Cogswell and San Gabriel?
They have some locations actually up in the canyon, some areas they're hauling it to that is secure. And Steve, you may have more information. So most of it is staying up in the canyon.
There's a burl cage. There's a site called Burl Canyon up there. They've used for years, and they've still got more room. They're still taking it up there. There's always the concern that they're just putting it up in the canyon so it can come back down. I mean, we've always had that concern, but they have a place where they're securing it so that it doesn't run off too much. But yeah, they take it right up back up the canyon. Hmm.
There's a lot of it.
A lot of work. It's expensive, yes.
I had a question too for you, Tom. So you were talking about the boundaries. How are they overlapping, or why does that happen?
So we have our boundaries, and we have a legal description of our boundaries and GIS maps, and we send them to the county. They use those maps to determine, you know, your division boundaries for each director, and when they do ballots, who they send ballots to, who gets to vote. And then the Metropolitan has information on our boundaries as well. And over the years, as those boundaries are reported, and frankly, as sometimes the GIS technology improves, unless you go look at detail and compare those, you're not aware that they're what Three Valleys sends to the county, what we send to the county, don't match up. And so we need to reconcile that.
So does that result in people getting, like, their ballots being how does that even – or is it just our side?
In theory, as far as we know, this has not happened. But in theory, it could be that somebody who technically – I mean, if technically should be in our division voted for a Three Valleys director because mm-hmm. they got a Three Valleys ballot.
Got it.
We don't know that that actually happened. Mm-hmm. And I would say a good chunk of these don't involve any residential properties, mm-hmm. but some of them do. And so we just want to make sure it's right, and we're trying to get it done before the next election in case there are any incidents where somebody should be residing in our district or in Three Valleys. I don't think anybody's got ballots for both, but.
No. Not that we know of, but I think more importantly, it would resolve any discrepancies in terms of ensuring that, you know, the properties are allocated the appropriate fees.
Yes.
Yeah, the property taxes, standby charges, et cetera.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Tom. Okay, next item is director's comments. We'll start with Director Travis.
Yes, it's a political season as far as the presidential election is going on, and you know, I'm a political junkie. I'll watch CNN until it's a commercial, and I'll switch to Fox until it's a commercial. I keep going back and forth. And a lot of people, you know, pay attention to the Iowa caucus, which is the first, you know, elections out there. The candidates go out there 1-2 years in advance. They try to visit all 99 counties. This year they spent $77 million on campaign ads, and the victor in this case is already declared the nominee of the party. So a lot of attention spent on Iowa. But if you look at the raw numbers of votes, and all our divisions are about, you know, the same size, and we all get about the same amount of votes. But just speaking for my division itself, I got, in my little community, I got more votes than DeSantis and Haley combined. And I was very close to Trump. I got over 44,000 votes in my division here, and yet those amount of people in Iowa are pretty much deciding who the next president's going to be. So, we pay a lot of attention to these early states, and you wonder why they have so much clout in California. You know, we have 40 million people in California, and you would think that we should have some say-so on the presidential elections. Although we do move it from June, from June back to March elections, but the election's pretty much over or decided as far as the primary. So, I just want to say that I will not seek nor accept the nomination for the president of the United States, no matter how many votes I got in my division. So.
You know, it's bothering me more than anything lately is. In my district, we all represent like 250,000 people.
Yeah.
And it costs sometimes $60,000 to campaign if you have an opponent. And then I see Monterey Park, somebody wins with 500 votes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it just is not fair. Yeah. Oh, well, they know who's going to win before the – I used to cover city ministry.
That's interesting. Thank you. Director Garcia?
No comments other than I'm excited for our Women in Water event tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah, better be good.
Director Fellow?
Tom, you have this this schedule or whatever it is about future board workshops. You know, it would be a good one, but it's. I think we have to do it in summer or something. It's yesterday we've been having meetings at Met. It's a full-time job now. It's every week. Last week, workshops, yesterday, workshops. And as Tom and I have talked yesterday in the Pure Water, which I'm a committee member, Carl Seckel from Orange, or from
MODOC.
Asked a great question, and I thought it was something that had to be asked, is that we have all these things on the table. We have Pure Water. We have the Delta. We have the Colorado River. What else do we have? Desalting by Cayugas and Las Virgenes. And Met's got to get a handle on all this. We're $480 million in debt. And he asked a great question, is that we have to start looking at this stuff. And we're going through many workshops, camp, of how we're going to – scenarios of how we're going to pay for all this. But – he brought up a question about Pure Water, especially that it's just growing in costs, and now it's almost. I was hoping it would be 6 years. It would be online. Let's just hope we're alive by the time it gets online. Some people are saying 25 years now, and he said, should we put all of our eggs in one basket? What should we be doing? And so, what we need to do is to lay out everything, every project, how much money it's going to cost. Where are we going to get the money? And there's no talk of bonds anymore. And I don't know if the governor really controls bonds, and I don't know if he'll allow us to do a bond. But then I said some things about, you know, we've got to start moving. And I asked Adele at the meeting, you know, when are we going to approve? That project's not even approved yet. And so by 2025, January, it has to be approved by the board. But we've got to look at all of these scenarios. We've got to look at every single project and how much bang for our buck are we going to get? Like some people at Met now are saying, maybe we can get more from the state water project. That might be a better investment. And so maybe in the summer, to give us all an explanation of what projects are on the table and the cost, if hopefully Met will have that statistics, but there's so much on the table, and I'm just worried about where we're going to get the money.
Give a little bit of an explanation? So one of the things I have on this list, this is for future board workshops, and I'll talk about that when we talk about future agenda items, is Camp for Water. So that is the new process the Met is going through to do exactly what you said. Now, I'm not saying I'm optimistic that that is going to be an easy or non-controversial process, but the intent of Metropolitan is to put Pure Water, Delta Conveyance, Desal, East-West Conveyance into portfolios of projects to fill the gap. They've already identified under certain climate and demand scenarios they have a gap in supply. They need more supply. And what's the best portfolio of projects to to close that gap. And so that's the intent of the Camp for Water process. Now, there's 26 member agencies. There's 36 board members. They've set up the special task force. They may have done this in the past. It's the first time I'm aware that they've done it, where they have a committee of the Metropolitan Board who has general managers sitting on that task force. And I think that turned out to be a pretty good idea because it gives the general managers who are more in tune with the technical merits of water policy or water resources management to offer input. So I think it is helping the process move along. And their intent is to have a preliminary draft report as early as April, and I don't know how we're going to get there. But we're making very slow progress. The last meeting, many of my colleagues felt like we were making progress. So I just want to assure you that what you're talking about is putting all this into a evaluation to find out what is the best approach to solve the gap is being worked through this Camp for Water process. That being said, we have to be fully engaged with that process and fully pay attention. Not all general managers are on that task force. I'm invited. We got a couple other San Gabriel general managers on that task force, and then others representatives from the family. But Director Fellow attends those meetings. So he sits at the table and asks questions. Even though he's not on the committee, Director Fellow is engaged. So that's what the plan is to look at Pure Water Southern California. What does that gain? How much is it going to cost? How is that going to impact our rates? State water conveyance, other projects and ideas. They've even thrown out if San Diego has oversubscribed for water with their desal project and the Imperial Irrigation Transfer, maybe we should look to that and say maybe that's an option. As if they've oversubscribed, maybe that's another less expensive source of water. So everything's on the table as they go into that process. We haven't even put the portfolios together yet, and if they want a draft report by April, I think we got a lot of work to do. But that's what I was going to say to that. And I'll talk about this list under future agenda items. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. But we do. There's so much work at Met that has to be done. And then we have some other problems that are going to be, we'll be hearing about very shortly, about hiring of people without board approval. That's going to hit the fan, and it's already been in some of the newspapers. But it's a big job right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Interesting news. The Camp for Water sounds like we need to find something to move forward with. That's how you make progress. You find a path and you move forward with it, whatever it is. So hopefully we can stop discussion at some point and move towards the solution.
And build.
Yeah. I don't really have anything under director's comments. Future agenda items. I have something. Mm-hmm. Mine's going to be quick. I would just like to add, if we could, Pioneer Park to the future agenda. We had a good presentation of that at one of the committees, and it'd be great to bring that to the board.
President Santana, I think you're referring to the Pointy Hills Landfill Park project.
Yeah, it's Pioneer Park, right?
No.
That's El Monte.
Oops. I'm sorry. Yes, the Landfill Park
the
project.
The Pointy Hills Landfill Park project.
Yes, my apologies. Thank you for coming. All right.
And then a handout in front of you today is potential future workshop topics. Typically, the second meeting of the month we do as a workshop. Today was Stephen O'Neill on ethics. And so this is just a list. What I want to hear from the directors, is there other topics that you have of interest? Are there any of these that you are more interested in hearing about sooner than later? Director Fellow, Camp for Water is on here, okay, and I wrote down April or May.
You know what I'm more interested in than Camp for Water is Cayegas and Las Virgenes. I feel sorry for them. They cannot go through another drought. They were down to no water. And right now they're doing some interesting things with Tim Quinn and desalting. And I would love to even invite Matt here and Peterson here to talk about some of this stuff. It's so interesting. They're trying to produce desalted water with new technologies that Tim Quinn is, I guess, involved in.
So let me know. Let staff know which of these you may be interested in, if you think you'd like to hear about some of them sooner than later. Some of them are kind of based on when things come out. For instance, Steve typically probably, what did we say, Steve, in March? Will give us an update on the River Water Master Report and the Water Master, kind of the Water Master, Basin Water Master, River Water Master 101. On the PFAS and Title 22 monitoring, that's something we asked Water Master to do, because that's Water Master's data. The producers use Water Master to collect the Title 22 reports, so we'll have asked Water Master to cover those things. Colorado River, we actually have that on the schedule for February 28th. Bill Hazenkamp, Colorado River Manager for MWD, will make a presentation to us on the Colorado River agreements. So let me know.
Thank you. If I could, for the PFAS, I know I've mentioned I'm interested in that. If possible, if we are going to do a presentation on that, it would be interesting to hear why it's important, the PFAS, and what it is that's the concern with that in our water supply. I just wanted to add that. Thank you. Okay. Adjournment to closed session. Do we have any closed session today?
We do not.
All right. In that case, we will adjourn today's meeting. Thank you very much.